Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Over the past few weeks, there have been widespread protests against police killings after the shootings of Alton Sterling in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and Philando Castile in Falcon Heights, Minnesota. These are the latest of several fatal shootings of black men. So far this year, according to The Guardian's The Count Project, more than 500 people have been killed by police, most African American. Now, over the past year, we have done so many shows on these issues. The national conversation continues, and the same questions are being asked over and over again. So in times like these, what is the role of the media? How are journalists covering these tragedies and this violence? How are they dealing with and reacting to social media? We are now living at a time when we can watch shootings just seconds after they happen. And that is the case with Philando Castile. Just seconds after he was killed, his girlfriend went live on Facebook. So joining us to talk about the role of the media in times like these are three journalists. Daniel Denvir is a reporter with Salon, covering criminal justice, policing, inequality, and politics. Daniel's latest piece is called Politicians Run the Police State. They declared the war on crime that sends cops into battle. Hi, Daniel. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks so much. It's Denver, by the way.
Denver, thank you. Sorry about that.
No worries.
We're also joined by Leonard Pitts, a nationally syndicated columnist and winner of the 2004 Pulitzer Prize for Commentary. Leonard's column runs on Sunday and Wednesday in the Miami Herald, and his latest column is called On Race, Our Behavior Proves Us Liars. Hi, Leonard. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. And Michael Doyle is a legal affairs correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers based in Washington. Michael's latest piece is The Robot as a Lethal Weapon in Dallas May Have Been a First. And he is referring to the bomb robot that was used to kill Micah Johnson, the Army reservist who shot and killed five police officers and wounded seven others in Dallas last week. Hi, Michael. Welcome to the show.
Glad to be with you.
Great to have you. So as we always do on Your Calls Media Roundtable, we start off on a positive note and highlight journalism that stood out, really good journalism. So let's start off with you, Daniel. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I guess it's a positive note in terms of the journalism and the job well done on journalists' part, but it's a pretty upsetting story. The Marshall Project did a really excellent and troubling investigation in collaboration with the New York Times, looking at this little-known corner of the American criminal justice system, which is private companies contracted that local jurisdictions contract out to transport prisoners between localities and states. And what they discovered is basically a nearly entirely unregulated industry that profits off of moving oftentimes low-level offenders in brutal conditions using guards that are underpaid and undertrained and overworked. And they uncovered just some horrific stories about people, a man who was killed after allegedly being beaten to death on the orders of a guard, all sorts of horrible things. But in response, I haven't looked into it deeply, but apparently the Justice Department has pledged to investigate the industry. So that's good news.
I was wondering about that because that piece broke earlier this week, right? You wrote about it. Democracy Now! Actually had on a woman who said that because she turned in her rental car late, she was actually transported. She was the only woman in the van. They also interviewed a former driver who basically said his conscience got the best of him because he was transporting a pregnant woman who was having seizures. And he was actually holding her throughout the trip, giving her caffeine to prevent her from having seizures. But I didn't really see any other follow-up, and I just wondered what happened as a result. Did you see more follow-up in the media after that report came out?
Not that I know of yet, but the Marshall Project and Muckrack have developed a guide and various tools that local reporters can use to dig deeper into the story, because they were really telling like a big picture national story about this troubling industry. But there are, you know, an untold number of jurisdictions around the country that are actually contracting with these private prisoner transportation extradition companies. And so I think local media could and hopefully will have a major impact when they dig deep into what their governments are doing and why they're contracting out to these often very dangerous and unregulated companies.
I'd love to ask all of you just briefly, when a big investigative piece like this comes out from the Marshall Project and the New York Times, you know, because we're living in this social media world, a report came out recently, and we'll find it, that found people click without reading. People are not really reading lengthy articles anymore. And Michael, I just wonder, what are your thoughts? I mean, 10 years ago, I'm guessing, this piece probably would have gotten a lot more play than it has now.
Well, I follow the practice. I often will retweet or forward through social media a story, a good piece in Salon or Slate or the New York Times, just based on the headline or the topic matter. But I'd also say, speaking as a reporter, often my first attitude toward a big project like that is sheer dread that the editor will see it and want me to follow up in some way, which will never be satisfactory because I can never catch up to what had been done before. That's a craven attitude, but it is a true one.
And what are your thoughts, Leonard? What are your thoughts on just the effect that these lengthy investigations have or don't have in today's media world?
Well, I think there's so much chatter in today's media world with, you know, the traditional media, new media, social media, et cetera, that it becomes really difficult for anything of any kind of substance to sort of break through. We have a very short attention span. We have the, you know, attention span in this society, you know, of a gnat on cocaine. And I think it's, it was always bad, but it's probably gotten worse with the result of, as I said, this explosion of media. So it's occasionally something breaks through, but more often than not, we sort of tend to look at whatever it is or look at the headline and the first few lines, wring our hands, and then, you know, before we can even process that, we're on to the next thing.
Right. And Daniel, I'm glad that you noted that the Department of Justice is going to look into this, because even if these stories don't get the attention they deserve in the media, chances are something is going to happen behind the scenes. Government officials are paying attention, and often laws change or investigations are conducted, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one sense in which A1 of the New York Times still matters tremendously. I think people in positions of power still notice when a damning investigation like that gets published in that real estate.
And so kudos to the Marshall Project and the New York Times. The piece is called Inside the Deadly World of Private Prisoner Transport. Tens of thousands of people every year are packed into vans run by for-profit companies with almost no oversight. It's a very lengthy piece, and we'll add a link at yourcallradio.org. And we just found the study that I cited. The Washington Post had a piece called 6 in 10 of you will share this link without reading it, a new depressing study says. We might have to do a show about that in the future. So thank you so much for bringing that up, Daniel. That's Daniel Denver. He's a reporter with Salon. What about you, Leonard? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I have to confess, I'm just coming back from vacation, so I've made it a point to see very little. but I will say that the one thing that I did see, if you allow me to sort of expand the definition of journalism just a bit, one thing that stuck with me, and I ended up retweeting a couple of times, was a cartoon from a political cartoonist, Jim Moran, who works for the same paper I do, the Miami Herald. In the wake of the police shootings and the Dallas tragedy, he has this image of a white police officer and a black Lives Matter protester arm in arm, and his caption is, "We had better overcome," and they're both there united in their grief, and that just struck me as saying a lot that needs to be said, and saying it in a new way, and saying it with an almost wordless eloquence that I found really compelling and affecting, because what it spoke to was not just the grief that we all share, but the fatigue that I think you alluded to at the beginning, mm-hmm. and also the sense of urgency that, you know, where do we go if we, you know, what happens to us if we don't get this right?
Yeah, exactly. It's interesting, Leonard, I don't think anyone's ever given kudos to a cartoon on our during our section, so I'm glad you did that.
Thank you.
And what is the name of the cartoonist again?
Jim Moran.
Moran,
Morin.
Okay, so kudos to Jim Moran. Thank you for that. That's Leonard Pitts. He is a nationally syndicated columnist, and his columns run Sunday and Wednesday in the Miami Herald. What about you, Michael? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
I like to recommend a piece that has nothing to do with law enforcement or the legal system. It was in the July 11th and July 18th combined issue of The New Yorker. It was by the writer Larissa McFarquhar. It's called The Threshold, and it's about a hospice nurse in Brooklyn, and it talks about her particular experiences dealing with the near-to-death patients that she has. It talks in general terms and broad terms about the hospice and how it operates, but it is an acutely intimate story about a most painful moments in people's lives and how one woman does her best to shepherd them through to the other side. It's a beautiful piece of writing.
Sounds nice. So kudos to the New Yorker's Larissa McFarquhar.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you for that. And we will put links to all of these pieces at yourcallradio.org. And that is Michael Doyle. He's legal affairs correspondent for McClatchy. So I'd like to start off by asking you all just a really general question. During times like these, what is the role of the media? I mean, even putting this show together, we were thinking, all right, what angle should we take? There are so many. There's been so many writings about what's been happening, about the police shootings, about the shootings of the police, about the robot bomb. And so many of us are tired of having these conversations. We feel like the same questions are being asked over and over again, and it just continues. So, Leonard, you're a columnist. When you sit down to write a column during times like these, how do you decide what to focus on?
It gets more and more difficult, not just with stories about race, but frankly with stories about shootings and mass shootings. It gets more and more difficult because it happens so frequently, and you're right, you do find yourself saying the exact same thing. I tend to believe, I've always defined my role, particularly in times like this, as to be able to provide some context and to give a sort of a more depthed view of what the issue is. In this case, you know, African Americans and their sort of fraught relationship with the police. A lot of people find it, I think, easier to look at this only in terms of what's before our eyes now, what's been before our eyes for the last few years. But I think it's necessary if you're going to understand this, and if you're going to understand the depth of anger that you're seeing in African-American communities, it is necessary to go back and realize that we've been having some form of this discussion or dealing with some form of these issues for literally decades. Mm-hmm. This is not a new thing, and it's, as I tried to point out in the most recent column that I wrote, this is not just about the police. The police are a reflection of a larger issue, which is that we have a society that is, you know, for all that we like to celebrate the progress that we have made since the civil rights years, is still, you know, just riven by race, and not only riven by race, but ignorant of the ways in which it's riven by race, willfully ignorant of the ways it's riven by race, and scared to talk about it. We talk at it, but we really don't deal with it in any meaningful sense.
And to use your words, you write, our society is riven by race, defensive about race, terrified of race. We say we seek understanding and light, yet too often generate only noise and heat. If America is ever to reconcile itself, that has to change. It's fine to demand better training, more body cams, more community liaisons, but to lay the onus entirely on the men and women in blue is to delude ourselves. Ultimately, the police are not the problem. We are. What kind of response did you get to this column?
Not a whole lot. The message boards were fairly quiet. The email was along the lines of what I expected. There's one individual who wrote me that, matter of fact, he tweeted me, and I just tweeted him back, young black men are the most dangerous people in the country. And that was his entire response, mm-hmm. which is, again, you know, it's sort of this whole will it go round in circles thing. It's the merry-go-round of this discussion. And whenever you try to get off the merry-go-round, and whenever you try to get people past their sort of practiced responses and their defensive, you know, positions, it is exceedingly difficult. Every once in a while you can, but most often when pushed on this, people, white, you know, people who really don't want to hear the other stuff, and that's not all of them, but that is many, you know, we'll retreat to these sort of defensive positions. It is okay for me to feel the way I do because, you know, black people are scary to me, and here's why, that sort of thing. And it, you know, I've taxed my powers of persuasion in trying to figure out ways to get people to see beyond that and to get people to fear less, but it's proven very difficult.
Leonard, how long have you been writing your column?
I've been writing this column for 22 years.
22 years. Mm-hmm. A seasoned journalist, Leonard Pitts, nationally syndicated columnist, writing for the Miami Herald. You can find his latest piece on race, Our Behavior Proves Us Liars. Michael Doyle, you're a legal affairs correspondent for McClatchy. What do you think is the role of the media in times like these?
It's an interesting way you phrase the question. The first thing to point out is that in today's environment, everybody literally is the media. The ability to post videos and information and updates through Twitter or Facebook or other social media means that everybody is the media, which means you're referring to the professional media. The role of the professional media, in my mind, is to get it right, to speak the truth, to find the facts, to clarify the ambiguous, to provide the context, so that people who are bombarded with supposition and ranting from the internet can find a home in the facts. So I'd say the role of the media is to get it right.
How long have you been a reporter, Michael?
Since 1980.
Another seasoned journalist. So, Michael, I mean, you've seen so many changes over your time as a reporter, specifically social media, and it seems like, you know, social media has really pressured reporters to get the story out first. It's also pressured people to have everyone to have an opinion about everything. How has that affected your reporting?
It certainly sped up the reporting. So if I'm writing a story about a Supreme Court decision, I'm going to Twitter, and you know, within seconds we'll tweet out the Supreme Court on Thursday upheld gay marriage or whatever the case is. And then it's on my shoulders to write a first take of the story within 5 or 10 minutes. That's a wire service mentality. And then it's my obligation to write the more thorough take, get reactions, and put it into context. So it's, you know, the old 24/7 wire service deadline is something that is upon every reporter's shoulder these days. It's sped up the metabolism. It's placed a premium on the ability to write and think fast. I mean, it's fun, don't get me wrong, but it's also fraught with all kinds of dangers.
You also teach advanced news reporting at George Washington University. What is the conversation you have with your students about tragedies like these and how to cover them?
Actually, I'm teaching introductory reporting now. In the very first class, I play the 911 tapes from the Aurora shootings from 2012. Play 3 or 4 minutes of this highly tense, anxiety-filled, chaotic audio environment where people are reporting there's mass casualties in a movie theater and outside of Denver. And then I walk through with the students, how would we cover that? What would we do in the case of a mass tragedy? How do you assign reporters? How do you make decisions on what to air? How do you decide what not to air? And so it's a real-life scenario that I start with that immerse them in the sort of real-world decisions they'll be facing in the field.
Michael Doyle is a legal affairs correspondent with McClatchy, and he teaches introductory and advanced news reporting at George Washington University. Daniel Denver is a reporter at Salon covering criminal justice. Daniel, you have written a couple of lengthy pieces that have gotten a lot of shares on Facebook, Criminalizing the Hustle, Policing Poor People's Survival Strategies from Eric Garner to Elton Sterling. And then your latest one, Politicians Run the Police State. They declare the war on crime that sends cops into battle. We'll talk specifically about your pieces, but what are your thoughts about the role of the media in times like these and the angles that reporters choose to take?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with a lot of what's been said in terms of, you know, on the basic level, it's about figuring out and verifying facts, and then from there on, providing context both in terms of what's going on at the present and also historical. And I think that the media is actually, a lot of different reporters have been doing a really great job with that. Just recently in the New York Times, Nicole Hannah-Jones and another reporter did a really well contextualized piece on black neighborhoods on the south in southern Dallas and their experiences with policing and how that contradicted contradicts the sort of rosy picture that's been painted around recent reforms around the use of force in the city. Jennifer Gonerman and Sarah Stillman at the New Yorker really zooming out and looking at the big picture of how prosecution and incarceration and criminalization work in this country. A few years back, the Times-Picayune in New Orleans doing this amazing report uncovering the kind of money-driven prison system in the parishes of Louisiana that basically gave a cash incentive to lock people up. So I think I think that the role of the media is to really dig in behind and beyond these really horrifying videos of police shootings, which are I'm so glad they're there. They're so horrifying, but they really are shedding a light on an important and disturbing issue. But it's the media's job to then try to give information and context and explanation to the public of these broader issues of systems of policing and mass incarceration and excessive prosecution, these bigger picture issues that you can't fit into a disturbing video that can be shared online, but that are incredibly disturbing in their own right, if a little more complex and potentially boring.
Right, and videos have completely changed everything because we can now watch things happen in real time. In the case of the shooting of Philando Castile in Falcon Heights, Minnesota, his girlfriend went live on Facebook seconds after he was shot. And so people who were watching it saw it before most people, media, police, most people even knew this was happening. Leonard Pitts, what are your thoughts on that and how real-time video and just the video that gets out so quickly, how does that change the reporting and the decisions that reporters make in trying to tell the story?
Well, I think, again, I speak as someone who's not necessarily so much a reporter as an opinion writer, columnist, but I would tend to believe that that the video functions as another tool, essentially, for them. But it's a tool that they don't get to look at. The reporter doesn't get to look at it in isolation. It's a tool that the reporter's looking at the same time that the people, the public is seeing it. I think the more important thing, or the more telling thing that or the effect that those videos have is that it reduces the ability of police or whomever to manufacture untruths, and it. It's interesting because again these stories have been going for years and there've been decades of people saying, well, the police did such and such, and the police would deny, and that would be pretty much the end of it. Now we have these videos, and people are able to see for themselves that often, not always, but often, there's a variance between the story that the police tell and the story that the cameras tell. What is interesting to me is how little ultimately that seems to mean in terms of. In terms of changing or altering people's opinions. I think that some of us are so invested in a reality of African-American dangerousness and Black Lives Matter as a terrorist group, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that even when we see evidence to the contrary with our very own eyes, or even when we see things with our very own eyes that at the very least should cause a fair person to question, they are unable to sort of make that leap. To me, that's the fascinating thing that's happened with video. When Walter Scott was shot in the back by a police officer in North Carolina, it's a pretty cut-and-dried video, and I had readers, nevertheless, making excuses for how that could have happened and how the police officer could have been in the right. The same when LeVar Jones was shot in South Carolina by a police officer named a trooper, Sean Grubert. There's still people making excuses because there's a difficulty in making the leap to confess, the reality that's actually before the very eyes.
Hmm. Well, and also now we're getting news about what happens to people who sometimes take these videos. On Wednesday, Democracy Now! Had two pieces. Meet Abdullah Maflahi. He filmed Alton Sterling shooting and was then detained by Baton Rouge police. And another story, police arrest and detain Air Force veteran for 26 hours after he posted Alton Sterling shooting video. And these are really interesting stories, not getting much attention in the media, but Democracy Now! Covered that on Wednesday. Today, it is our media roundtable, and we're asking a very simple but important question. What is the role of the media in times like these? I feel like we've been asking the same questions over and over again for the past couple of years, and this just continues. So what are your thoughts? What questions should the media be asking right now? What has stood out for you over the past couple of weeks? Where have you seen solid reporting? We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. Email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Daniel Denver is a reporter with Salon. Michael Doyle is a legal affairs correspondent for McClatchy. And Leonard Pitts is a nationally syndicated columnist. His columns run in the Miami Herald. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, local public radio. If you have a perspective you haven't heard in today's discussion or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. You may post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org, or you may tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @yourcallradio. Coming up at 11 o'clock in a half an hour, it's Inflection Point here on 91.7 KALW.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we will start special coverage of the Republican and Democratic national conventions. And we're going to kick it off by talking about the state of the Republican Party. The rise of the Tea Party and the ascendancy of Donald Trump has led to what many describe as the end of the party, with the center of power shifting even further to the right. Where is the GOP heading? We're also doing shows on protests. We're going to do a show about Donald Trump, and then we'll take a break from the conventions, and we'll be joined by Jules Boykoff to talk about his new book, Power Games, A Political History of the Olympics. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it's our media roundtable. We are talking about police shootings, the shootings of police, the use of a robot to kill Micah Johnson. That's the Army reservist who shot and killed five police officers last week in Dallas. What questions should the reporters be asking right now? What really stands out for you in the media? We're joined by Daniel Denver, reporter with Salon, Leonard Pitts, nationally syndicated columnist. His columns run in the Miami Herald. And Michael Doyle is legal affairs correspondent with McClatchy. Michael, I know we have to let you go soon, but I wanted to talk with you about your piece you wrote with colleagues called The Robot as a Lethal Weapon in Dallas May Have Been a First. So last week, the Dallas police chief said he gave his approval to use a remote-controlled bomb robot to kill the gunman, Army veteran Micah Johnson. Later, he said he would use it again. What did you find out about what went on behind the scenes in making this decision?
Behind the scenes in the decision-making, I didn't find out much more than any other reporter. I'm in Washington, D.C. We did certainly find out more about the system under which cities like Dallas obtain robots, often from the Defense Department. This particular robot was a 485-pound monster, what cost about $151,000. It was manufactured by a subsidiary of defense contractor Northrop Grumman. And it was conveyed to the Dallas law enforcement agency, not for lethal purposes originally, but for bomb disposal. Not unlike about 700 bomb disposal robots have been conveyed by the Pentagon to local agencies nationwide. My colleague Christopher Huffaker ran the data and found all kinds of examples of other police departments that had obtained robots. Just right in the Bay Area, in the Antioch Police Department in the East Bay, received two what are called TAC bots in the last couple of years, designed for bomb disposal. What questions are raised by the episode in Dallas is whether the Antioch Police Department or the Manteca Police Department or others with these robots would convert them from bomb disposal to villain-killing purposes.
There have been a number of articles looking at the ethical and legality, the ethical questions and the legality of using this robot. How do you think journalists should cover this? Because we've done a lot of shows about the militarization of police forces in the United States.
It's a great topic, and I think the first advice I'd have for reporters, and including for myself, is to follow this very, very closely, because the use of the robot for lethal purposes in Dallas was a precedent. And the thing about precedents is that they are followed by successive acts. So every police department that has one of these robots in the country is going to be looking at whether they can modify the use, raising questions like, well, we have aerial drones for surveillance purposes. Could we equip them with tear gas or non-lethal or even lethal weapons? Should we follow the Chinese practice? This year, the Chinese government unveiled something called the ANBOT, which is a law enforcement robot that's capable of autonomously patrolling neighborhoods and delivering electroshocks. You raise questions about whether, in fact, robots should be sent out autonomously at all. All kinds of consequences will flow from what happened in Dallas, and the job of the reporters is to track every one of them.
And these robots have been dispensed to 241 agencies in 41 states. According to government records, California received the most, 160, followed by Texas, 122. Do we know if a robot like this has been used before by a police department?
Not in this way. By all indication, this was the first time such a robot was used for lethal purposes. Robots have been used for non-lethal law enforcement purposes. They can be equipped with tear gas emitters. They can be equipped with fire hoses. They can be equipped with pepper gas dispensers. And they have been in the past to incapacitate criminals or alleged criminals in a non-lethal way. That is increasing. But again, this in Dallas was apparently the first time it's been used to kill someone deliberately.
Michael, we have one call for you, and then we'll let you go. Is that all right?
That's fine.
Okay, great. Let's hear from Mark in San Francisco. Hi, Mark.
Hi, thank you. I have actually two quick questions about the Dallas situation. One is, as far as what happened in that parking garage, I think it's easy to imagine that these police in the garage with the suspect were itching to kill this guy, not to put too fine a point on it. After he had killed a bunch of police officers, one can imagine, and blowing him to bits probably seemed like a great thing to do. And why do we believe exactly the police account? Without question, the media seems to say, okay, yep, here's what happened, here's what the police say, and that's what happened. And may I ask my other quick question about that?
Sure. Go ahead.
Okay. As the things that seem uncovered, as much media coverage as there was, what about the people who were arrested? They said several people were arrested that night. What happened to those people? Were they released? What happened? And the other question, why do we never talk about the people wounded, only how many are killed? I'd like to know what happened to those people who were wounded, those police officers.
All right, you raised several questions there. We mentioned that Micah Johnson killed five police officers and wounded seven others. But you're right, I saw a story about those who've been killed. I haven't really seen anything about those who were wounded. Michael, Mark wanted to know, in these cases, you basically have a police account and that's it. So I wondered, the police said that in their interactions with Micah Johnson, he said that he wanted to kill white people. He said he was angry about the police shootings. He was also angry about Black Lives Matter. I don't know if he was angry about it or if he supported Black Lives Matter. It's very unclear. But how were they able to have that conversation with this man that they were trying to shoot? Do we have that information?
Somebody has that information. I do not from my remote location. I understand Mark's question. I would question the use of the phrase itching to kill. No doubt police officers, having seen their brethren gunned down, had emotions running high. I think it does a disservice to their presumed professionalism to say they were itching to kill. It is always appropriate to question the first accounts. We've had too many examples of first accounts being wrong, either willfully police or others lie, or just the fog of war leads to confusion. And that, and again, that's the job of the media, in particular the case of the Dallas media, who have the sources in the Dallas Police Department to tell us exactly what happened and how it unfolded.
Do you have any information about the others who were arrested? At first, we were told that there were three snipers on a building and possibly one shooter on the ground. And according to reports, other people have been arrested. Do you know what happened?
Yeah, well, no, not entirely, but that's a great example of what Mark was saying, and what we were talking about is first accounts being wrong.
Right.
The first news that came out, and it probably was through Twitter that I first saw it, had multiple snipers. And
right.
That was the understanding for some minutes or hours, and it was followed by the news being walked back somewhat. And that's a great danger we have in the fast-paced media environment today, is first accounts get wrong, or first accounts are wrong and get disseminated widely. Again, I would say the best source, and I haven't looked closely at the most recent reporting from Dallas, but as a general rule, in times of disaster, go to the most local press available. They have the sources, and they're most likely to track down the truth.
So, yeah, such a good point. Local media play such an important role in times like these, and that's where you can get a very different story. Michael, I know you have to leave us, so thank you so much for joining us again.
My pleasure. Thanks
Thank
for
you.
Having me.
Michael Doyle is legal affairs correspondent for McClatchy. You can find his story, The Robot as a Lethal Weapon in Dallas May Have Been a First, at yourcallradio.org. And sticking with us for the rest of the hour, Daniel Denver is a reporter with Salon, and Leonard Pitts is a syndicated columnist. His column runs in the Miami Herald. Daniel, how would you tackle Mark's question about the police driving the narrative?
I mean, I think generally that reporters need to be skeptical of any person providing them with a narrative, but particularly if the people or institutions providing that narrative are in a position of power with an interest to shape it in their own interests. I don't think that, I was not reporting on the ground in Dallas, so I don't really have anything to comment about on that question, but I think generally you often hear, just generally speaking about incidents involving police, you generally hear very quick statements released by departments, often exonerating the officer's action and repeating the officer's initial account to police supervisors and investigators as fact before they've been independently investigated, and I definitely think it's reporters' job to not pass that along as gospel truth.
What do you think, Leonard?
Well, excuse me, I would co-sign what Daniel said about the need for skepticism, particularly with regard to authority figures in a situation like this where there is a vested interest in shaping the narrative in a certain way. But with that said, I would point out that with Dallas, you can have all the skepticism that you want as a reporter, even if you're a reporter on the ground there. On what basis or what evidence can you gather to question their account when they were the only ones on the scene, with the exception of the suspect who is now deceased? So, it's kind of a catch-22 in that regard in this specific case, because if it was not, as we have been told, we have no way of ever knowing.
And what are your thoughts on reporting about the man who was killed? Micah Johnson, he was deployed to Afghanistan in 2013. He returned to the United States the following year. He served in the Army until April 2015, and according to reports, interviews with neighbors, interviews with his family, he was a completely changed person when he got back from Afghanistan. I mean, we've heard this many, many times over the years. How do you think, Leonard, the media should tackle this? It seems like there were stories about him based on his family and neighbors, and then the story just ended there. What about the follow-up? What should that look like?
Again, there's the who is Michael Johnson story, but there's also the how did he become who he became story.
Right.
And to me, that's part of a larger narrative that probably hasn't gotten a lot of coverage, which is the fact that he's hardly the first person to serve in our military and come back radicalized or come back radically changed. Timothy McVeigh is the obvious other example on the other extreme, but there's also people who have come back. There's emotional changes that have gone on. There's a high rate of suicide among people who are serving in our military these days. So there's this larger question of which he's a part. I'm really big on trying to see the intersectionality between these concerns. So the fact that he was he did this sensational act, and it was part of becomes part of a national discussion on race and policing, may be so sensational, may suck up so much of the air in the room that we forget to place it in this other context, which is how are our vets doing?
Right.
You see what I'm saying? And there's a whole other story there that I don't think necessarily gets covered, and this is part of that.
Exactly, and the help that they are, or in so many cases, are not getting when they get home. Daniel, do you want to jump in there?
Oh, yeah, I agree with that entirely. I mean, I think on the most basic level, we have to take the shooter's at his own apparent words, which is that he was upset about police brutality and shootings of black people, and that does reflect the fact that the situation is getting extremely volatile and the contradictions of the American criminal justice and policing systems are really exploding. But also, it's very true and very important that he was a veteran and that he was carrying a, from what I've read reported, a legally acquired modified AK-47 type weapon. What can be more American than someone taught how to shoot by the government and then legally acquiring a high-powered weapon that many would argue should not be legally available to the public? So I think it needs to be analyzed on both levels.
Are you seeing much of that analysis in the media? Because other than the neighbor said, the family member said, I'm not really seeing much analysis.
I can't really point to a piece that I think has done a great job of that, but it's possible I missed it.
Yeah, or hopefully someone's working on it now, because that would take a lot of on-the-ground reporting.
Definitely, and biographical, another thing in his past apparently was alleged sexual harassment within the military.
Right.
And you do, and you look back to the Orlando shooter, you do often see a history of physical violence against women in the background of people who later do horrible things against others.
I'm so glad you brought that up. You're right. The woman who said that he sexually harassed her said she had to get a restraining order also against him.
Yes.
And this just came out over the last couple of days.
Yeah, I mean, it's what Leonard said about it in the intersections, I think are important. I think that violence against women in the domestic sphere should be troubling in and of itself, but also points to people who can be dangerous more generally.
Right. Well, you can find articles about these issues at yourcallradio.org. Daniel Denver is a reporter with Salon, and his latest piece is Politicians Run the Police State. They declared the war on crime that sends cops into battle. And Leonard Pitts is a syndicated columnist. His column runs Sundays and Wednesdays in the Miami Herald. His latest column is On Race, Our Behavior Proves Us Liars. And if you'd like to join us, today we are talking about the latest police killings, the killing of police. We were just talking about the robot that was used to kill Micah Johnson. And what really stood out for you over the last couple of weeks in times like these? What role should the media play? What questions should be asked? 866-798-8255. You can tweet us at Your Call Radio or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's go next to Mo in San Francisco. Hi, Mo. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. I wasn't calling about what happened in Dallas, but just one comment, and that's the silence of the NRA about this, because their whole contention was, you need to arm more people to combat folks who have assault rifles, and that's the way to kind of, limit limited damage, and here were people, police who were trained to shoot, and they didn't escape any of the killings that took place. But what I really wanted to ask was about the girlfriend of Sterling and her presence of mind to not only record what was happening, but to live stream it. And I'm just wondering, to follow up on Democracies Now, is what happens to the people who actually do these things? And was she trained? How did she? Was she prepared? I mean, she was obviously prepared in some way. And where did that come from? You know, is there something that's going on in the community that says, you know, you got to be alert to doing this? And it's one thing to, it's one thing to video something that's you're not directly involved, but this was astonishing.
You know, yes, a lot of people are talking about this. And so just to let you all know, Facebook has a new feature now called Facebook Live. And all you have to do is hit go live and you're live. And people on your feed can watch it in real time. It can be shared. And she went live and she was so calm. She's done so many more interviews since then. Talking about what the violence she has to deal with in her neighborhood. Her plan was to leave, and now she says she cannot. But we talked about this a little bit earlier, Leonard. This is completely new. And I am guessing that this is probably going to continue. When something happens, people are going to go live to ensure that enough people see it in real time.
Yeah, and that, you know, I'm on record as being really kind of opposed to the whole term or concept of citizen journalists, quote unquote. But this is one area in which I think I'd make an exception, because what they're doing is creating and preserving a public record.
Right.
I think it's not incidental that you've seen. I wrote about this in a column 2 or 3 years ago, that you've seen police departments and state legislatures trying to pass laws to prohibit people from recording police as they're doing their jobs. That is, to me, just as you know, as the opinion columnist, it strikes me as such a transparent, almost a tacit acknowledgement that there are times when those jobs are not done with the degree of professionalism and dispassion that we would expect, and that they tell us that they are done with. The fact that, you know, if you're doing your job and if you're doing your job properly, then you don't mind being recorded at doing it. It's only if you're doing something that you shouldn't be doing that you're kind of upset when a camera is rolling. So that, to me, speaks volumes.
I think it's increasingly people's immediate reaction in police encounters to turn on their phone and start recording, and these new Twitter and Facebook programs make that like a lot more effective and easier to do, because you can do them, you can live stream them. That said, there are countless stories of police abusing and arresting people for videotaping them in action, and the entire legal landscape is actually a little troubling. While some circuit courts in the country have said there is a clear First Amendment right to record police, which makes a lot of sense, obviously. Others have not yet done so, and so police in some places appear to be acting with impunity when they block people from recording them in action.
And thank you for the call, Mo. We will definitely do a show in the next couple of weeks about guns and these open carry laws and I think there was something like 15 to 20 based on reporting that people were actually walking around with guns at that protest. So we'll definitely do a show about this. Daniel, we're almost out of time. I just wanted you to give us a synopsis of the story you wrote, which is getting a lot of shares. Michelle Alexander, author of The New Jim Crow, cited this in one of her posts. Your piece, Criminalizing the Hustle, Policing Poor People's Survival Strategies from Eric Garner to Elton Sterling. Can you just give us a synopsis of that piece?
Yeah, I mean, the basic idea is that Eric Garner was allegedly or in suspicion of selling loose cigarettes when he was approached by NYPD officers, including Daniel Pantaleo. Elton Sterling was allegedly selling CDs. Large numbers of poor black people in this country for decades have been marginalized and excluded from the informal economy, which starts with being locked into segregated neighborhoods and segregated and underfunded schools, and then from there not able to get the sort of remunerative jobs that one would like to expect in this country. And from there, people turn to all sorts of hustles in both the gray and black market, from selling loose cigarettes to selling drugs. All of these are often likely to take place on the street, and thanks to things like broken windows policing, elicit a lot of negative police attention. And so this is one of these situations where you really see the economic marginalization of people being reinforced by over-policing and over-incarceration. And in the case of Alton Sterling and Eric Garner, ultimately contributing to their death at the hands of police.
Right, and so basically the state is sending the police in to police poverty, and as you write, Leonard, this problem ultimately is not about the police. This problem is about us. It's a reflection of the society, systemic racism, poverty, lack of opportunity. The list goes on.
You know, the point that I'm trying to make is that, you know, the police, for whatever attitudes they bring to the job, are not, the attitudes are not unique to policing. You know, police are a reflection of the society that they serve, and the society that they serve still is unable to let go of the bias, which says that there is something inherently dangerous, inherently inferior, inherently worthy of worth watching, inherently less moral about African American and other dark skinned people. Mm-hmm. And until we get that together, we cannot expect police ultimately get that together.
Yeah, and that this is an angle I'm hoping will get more attention, and we'll definitely do a show about this. Leonard Pitts is a syndicated columnist. His column runs Sundays and Wednesdays in the Miami Herald. His latest column, On Race, Our Behavior Proves Us Liars. Daniel Denver is a reporter with Salon covering these issues. Another story by Daniel, Politicians Run the Police State. They declared the war on crime that sends cops into battle. Find these pieces at yourcallradio.org. Leonard and Daniel, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, we'll discuss the state of the Republican Party. The rise of the Tea Party and the ascendancy of Donald Trump has led to what many describe as the end of the party. With the center of power shifting even further to the right, where is the grand old party heading? And what are the roots of the chaos in the Republican Party? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, Matt Martin is executive producer, and Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
Welfare reform was supposed to help people get a job. Now, 20 years later, only a quarter of welfare dollars goes to basic assistance. A lot of it goes to other things, like this couple's workshop in Oklahoma.
So we're going to talk about love styles.
I don't know if that's the best way to spend a budget.
We take a welfare reform road trip with Marketplace on the next Reveal.
Reveal will be heard on Monday at 11 a.m. right after Your Call here on KALW.
Coming up on the next Tavis Smiley Show from PRI, our court system is designed to be fair and impartial, but many see it as biased. Some of the nation's most distinguished jurists discuss how to create a more open relationship with the communities they serve and how the courts can deliver on the promise of justice for all. On the next Tavis Smiley Show from PRI.
12 noon today here on KALW San Francisco.
Welcome to Inflection Point, conversations with women changing the status quo. I'm Lauren Schiller. Today on Inflection Point, we bring you conversations from our growing Best Of collection while we take a short break. If you have a favorite, let us know at inflectionpointradio.org. There are billions of people across the world living in poverty. And it's not uncommon for girls in developing countries to be married off or working by the time they reach the fifth grade. But,
you know, the reality is if you keep a girl in school for the every year that she remains in school between 6th and 12th grade, her earning potential goes up by 15% on average every year.
Meet the new social entrepreneurs, Lila Jana of Sama Group and Erin Ganju of Room to Read. Breaking the cycle of poverty for millions of women. That's our inflection point. I'm Lauren Schiller. Stay tuned.